Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill for Thursday, April 2nd. The story, five takeaways from President Trump's address on Iran. President Trump delivered a primetime address about the war on Iran on Wednesday evening, more than a month after hostilities commenced. Trump's decision to launch the war in conjunction with Israel has come to look more and more risky. The conflict has been unpopular since its inception. Soaring gas prices and turbulence on the financial markets have sharpened the cost for Americans. In opinion polls, Trump's approval ratings have dropped to, or close to, the lowest point of his second term. The president and his allies insist he deserves credit for being willing to take action against Iran. They also emphasize the successes that have been notched by the U.S. military. Here are the main takeaways from Trump's speech. The headline claim, nearing completion. Trump spoke for almost 19 minutes, but much of his rhetoric amounted to little more than a repetition of things he has already said or posted on social media. The White House's intended headline from the speech seems to have been the claim from Trump that the U.S.'s core strategic objectives are nearing completion. Soon afterward, Trump added, "We're going to finish it very fast. We're getting very close." The claim is intended to reassure the American public that there is no danger of seeing another quagmire of the kind witnessed in Iraq and Afghanistan or a generation before in Vietnam. However, there was virtually nothing in terms of specificity from the president. The objectives he referred to are subjective by their nature. Also, countervailing the thrust in Trump's remarks, where he threatened Iran with still greater destruction, ultimately drew just as much attention. A speech notable for what was not said. From a news-making perspective, the speech was underwhelming. Speculation ran wild in the minutes before the speech began, too wild in retrospect. Forecasts that Trump would come to the cusp of withdrawing from NATO or open the door to using ground troops to seize Iran's enriched uranium proved wrong. The president instead once again rehashed Iran's long record of antagonism toward the U.S., complained about the nuclear deal that had been in place under former President Obama, and exulted in the damage that has been done to Iran's Navy and Air Force. The issue? None of this was remotely surprising to anyone who has even a passing acquaintance with all the things Trump has already said about the war. The central political difficulty for Trump has been the seeming inability to articulate a clear case for why the war was necessary right now. The failure has disconcerted even some in his own party. Last month, Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, was asked during an appearance on ABC News This Week what the primary objective of the war was. "I don't know, and I think it's a real problem," Tillis replied. It is a problem that Trump conspicuously failed to resolve on Wednesday night. An initial thumbs down from the markets. Trump always places a great deal of importance on reaction to his words and deeds on the markets. He won't have been pleased on Wednesday night. The price of oil spiked before his remarks. Brent crude oil just slightly under $100 right now, before his speech was given, stood above $106 roughly an hour after he finished. WTI crude also rose by more than 4%. Stock market futures across all three major U.S. indices also fell sharply, declining by around 1%. To be sure, markets can rebound quickly, and futures markets are particularly susceptible to abrupt changes in direction. Still, the negative market sentiment seemed to be driven by two factors: the lack of a clear timetable for an off-ramp from the conflict, and the more bellicose elements of Trump's address. The latter included the pledge that Iran was going to be hit extremely hard. "Over the next 2 to 3 weeks, we're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages, where they belong," Trump added. "In the meantime, discussions are ongoing." Trump tries to reassure public and blame Iran on gas prices. Escalating fuel costs are hitting Americans as the war goes on. The average price for a gallon of regular gas in the United States is now more than a dollar higher than before the conflict began. On Wednesday, Trump reiterated his claim that Americans are experiencing only a short-term increase in prices. He also sought to pin the blame directly on the Iranians, saying that the rise was entirely the result of the Iranian regime launching deranged terrorist attacks against commercial oil tankers in neighboring countries. This, in turn, he said, was yet more proof that Iran can never be trusted with nuclear weapons. Iran has been widely predicted to sail Gulf nations' oil assets and to try to close the Strait of Hormuz if it was attacked. The inability to get the strait reopened has dogged Trump so far. Later in his speech, Trump contended that when this conflict is over, the strait will open up naturally and gas prices will rapidly come back down. A brief respite, relatively speaking, for NATO allies. Predictions that Trump would really take a hammer to NATO and to key allies within it proved overblown. Trump's one allusion to such tensions amounted to remarks that hewed closely to a recent social media post. He said that many nations now struggling for fuel are those that had refused to get involved in the decapitation of Iran. We had to do it ourselves. Those nations, he added, should buy oil from the U.S. or build up some delayed courage, go to the Strait and just take it. Even if the suggestion is hard to imagine, coming from any other recent American president, it was well short of the full-on lashing some NATO nations were bracing for. The story: Trump's approval rating hits new low as Iran war squeezes economy. President Trump's approval numbers have slipped in recent weeks, hovering near the lowest levels of his second term, as Americans, including his conservative base, grow increasingly wary of a prolonged war in Iran that could portend trouble for the U.S. economy. Recent polling from YouGov and The Economist has Trump's approval rating down 4 percentage points since just before the U.S. struck Iran, falling from 39% in late February to 35% in the latest survey. A Reuters Ipsos poll similarly put Trump's approval at 36%, down from 40% earlier this month, while a Fox News survey found the president's disapproval rating at 59%, the highest level recorded in either of his terms. The shift has coincided with declining support for Trump's handling of the Iran war, which saw its sharpest drop yet this past week, as gas prices climbed to more than $4 for the first time since 2022, and the stock market tumbled to its lowest levels of the year. Trump, who spoke to the public Wednesday night about the conflict, saw his polling on Iran start out at 39% in early March before dropping to 36% for 2 weeks and then ticking down to 30% in the latest YouGov Economist survey. Jeffrey Skelly, chief elections analyst at Decision Desk HQ, said many concerns about the war are closely tied to views on the economy, which has long been one of Trump's strongest issues. The long-term problem for Trump has been that views about the economy have grown more negative during his presidency, Skelly said. When the things that you are viewed as strongest on become weaknesses, what do you have left to do to use as something to appeal to the public, he added. The erosion in Trump's support extends across the board, but it is particularly notable among his core backers and voting blocs that helped fuel his 2024 victory. In the last 5 weeks, since just before the Iran war began, Trump's overall support from his base has declined. He's down 6 points to 76% approval among his 2024 voters, down 4 points to 79% among conservatives, down 5 points to 81% among Republicans, and down 5 points to 92% among self-described MAGA supporters, according to YouGov Economist polling. And on the other side of the aisle, meanwhile, support has remained low. Approval is down 3 points among surveyed Democrats, 2 points among liberals, and 1 point among respondents who voted for former Vice President Kamala Harris in 2024. Among independents, Trump's approval stood at 25% in late February before ticking up to 31% in early March and falling to 22% in the latest poll. Trump has also seen support soften among key groups that backed him in recent elections, His approval among white voters dropped 4 points to 41%, while support among black and Hispanic voters dropped 1 point to 10% and 34% respectively. Among those without a college degree, Trump's approval rating declined from 43% to 37% over the last 5 weeks, while support among college graduates is stable at 32%. In 2024, Trump outperformed expectations among young voters who have been a reliable voting bloc for Democrats in recent elections. Although Trump started his second term with a plurality of support among voters younger than 30, the group has swung hard in the opposite direction, with only 24% approving of his performance in office, down from 32% in late February. The drop-off in Trump's overall approval rating comes as Americans broadly sour on the economy, with only 14% saying conditions are improving, down from 22% in late February in YouGov economist surveys. The shift is especially acute among Trump's base. The share of Republicans with an optimistic outlook on the economy has dropped from 50% in late February to 29% today. At the same time, GOP support for Trump's handling of Iran has also declined, falling from 83% in early February to 68% today. That drop comes as 61% of Americans, including 51% of Republicans, say they've noticed gas prices rising at the pump. It's not hard for people to see, oh, gas prices went up after we attacked Iran, and the Middle East is where a lot of oil comes from, Skelly said. You know, people are not dumb. They connect the dots on that. They launched this military operation, and whatever you think about the judgment of that, the politics of it are that people are not terribly happy with it, he added. And it's now, if anything, further exacerbating people's negative views about the economy. The story strikes on Iranian universities raise war crime questions, fears of retaliation. The same universities where students were protesting the Iranian regime weeks ago have shown up as rubble in news footage of the war. Almost 24 universities in the country have sustained damage, with questions arising as to whether the attacks on academic institutions constitute a war crime. Iran is threatening to retaliate against U.S.-affiliated schools in the region, causing multiple institutions to go remote. Iran's Ministry of Science said at least 21 universities have been damaged by strikes in the month-long war with the U.S. and Israel, CNN reported. The New York Times reported Israeli officials said at least one was being used for military research. Attacks on universities can be considered a war crime under international law, with specific justifications needed for targeting what is typically considered a civilian infrastructure. It's a two-part test to determine whether a university or another traditionally civilian object would qualify as a military object, said Elise Baker, senior staff lawyer with the Strategic Litigation Project at the Atlantic Council. The first part of the test is that the object or the location must make an effective contribution to military action through its use or other means. And then the second part is that the location's destruction, whether total or partial destruction, must offer a definite military advantage, Baker added. She said each strike against Iranian schools would have to be individually evaluated. And even if one could be a legitimate target, there are requirements around proportionality and precaution to avoid civilian harm as much as possible. One of the Iranian universities told state media four staff members were wounded in the attacks. It seems unlikely that there is evidence for every single one of these cases that really show that each of these strikes are legitimate and proportional and following all of the obligations under international law, Baker said. Iran has threatened attacks on U.S.-affiliated schools in surrounding countries, with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps announcing that all universities of the occupying regime and American universities in the West Asia region are legitimate targets for us until two universities are struck in retaliation for the Iranian universities that have been destroyed. The statement advised civilians in the region to stay 1 kilometer away from these institutions. There are many U.S. colleges, including New York University and Georgetown University, that have satellite campuses in nearby countries, such as Qatar and Saudi Arabia. The United States military is and was prepared to curtail any attacks by Iran, as evidenced by the 90% drop in ballistic missile and drone attacks by the terrorist regime, a White House official said when asked about the attacks on universities. Multiple schools in the region reportedly switched to online learning when the war began, and more are now joining after Tehran's threats. At this time, we have no evidence of direct threats against our university, its campuses, or medical centers. At the same time, out of an abundance of caution, we will operate fully online on Monday and Tuesday, with the exception of essential personnel. Accordingly, there will be no instructional activities or exams on campus during these 2 days, the president of the American University in Beirut said in a statement. Any attacks on American universities by Iran with the sole purpose of retaliation would also not hold up under international law, Baker said. Universities are not the only civilian areas that have become targets in the war with Iran, threatening the tech industry in recent days, as well as the abundant disruption in the energy sector. Addressing the nation on the conflict Wednesday evening, President Trump said the U.S. would very shortly wrap up its mission objectives, but added, we're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks, and we're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong. As the fighting rages on and accusations of war crimes hit both sides, it can be difficult to take action against countries, even if a violation occurs. There is an enforcement problem with international law, especially with actors like the U.S. and Israel that are very powerful states, and there's a lot of challenges in terms of holding actors accountable for international crimes, especially powerful actors. But in theory, if any of these attacks were war crimes, there should be prosecutions for war crimes that could happen in the U.S. or Israeli courts, Baker said. If the U.S. or Israeli forces were to have committed war crimes and those states failed to take action to investigate or hold their military actors accountable, then third states or potentially international courts would have the obligation and potentially jurisdiction to try to engage in that accountability practice, she added. That's where it becomes more difficult, but under the principle of universal jurisdiction, if any soldier or commander who is responsible for a war crime and travels to, for example, Germany, Germany could arrest and prosecute that individual for war crimes. The story, Trump's push to end Iran war bucks Israel's desire for regime change. President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu started the war against Iran together, but the two countries have divergent priorities as the U.S. president seeks to sell Americans on his endgame. While Trump has argued the killing of some senior Iranian leaders qualifies as regime change, the resulting shakeup does not represent the systemic overhaul that Israel has long sought to eliminate the threat from the Islamic Republic. Israel is more emphatic when it comes to creating this shockwave that ultimately brings about regime change, said Michael Herzog, Israel's former ambassador to the U.S. and a distinguished fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And if you don't want to find yourself fighting Iran every few years, you have to bring about regime change, a different regime with a different ideology. Netanyahu reportedly sold Trump on the idea, pushed by Israeli intelligence, that a war with Iran could mobilize an uprising against its hardline Islamic government. Trump outlined that vision in a video announcing the first wave of attacks on Iran, but has notably backed off the idea of a popular uprising in the weeks since. Facing growing domestic and international political pressure, Trump is now signaling he wants a swift exit from the conflict. He's swinging wildly between threats and demands, saying Iran must guarantee the free flow of energy through the Strait of Hormuz, while also dismissing responsibility for the key maritime trade route. He's claiming success in destroying Iran's nuclear capabilities, while also considering a risky operation to seize its enriched uranium. Trump's claim that the current Iranian leaders are a more reasonable bunch than their predecessors has been undercut by public statements from those now in power who have rejected Trump's maximalist demands. We do not have any faith that negotiations with the U.S. will yield any results, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said in an interview with Al Jazeera published Wednesday, acknowledging for the first time contact with the U.S. but downplaying talks to end the war. "We know very well how to defend ourselves. In a ground war, we can do it even better. We are completely ready to confront any sort of ground attack. We hope they do not make such a mistake," the U.S. reportedly told Israel, "to hold back assassination attempts on key Iranian interlocutors, including Argachi and Iran's parliamentary speaker Mohammad Bagher Kalibaf, to give negotiations a chance," Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who also serves as National Security Advisor, said in an interview with Al Jazeera on Monday that any differences between the U.S. and Israel amount to identifying the unique threats to each country. "What they are focused on is different," he said. "Those things are threats to them. Those mid-range missiles that Iran launches that reach into Israel, those are threats that they're facing. They're also facing a threat from Hezbollah in Lebanon, which they're confronting as well." Herzog said the level of coordination between the Israeli and American militaries over the course of a month of combat is unprecedented in Israel's history and demonstrates the cooperation and trust between the two countries. He pointed to one notable moment of disagreement between Trump and Netanyahu when the president issued a public scolding against the prime minister for hitting an Iranian gas field on March 18. "I told him, don't do that, and he won't do that," Trump told reporters in the Oval Office the day after sitting alongside Japan's prime minister. "What I see is a very close relationship between the two leaders," said Herzog, who was ambassador during the transition between the Biden administration and Trump's second term. "They speak a lot and are very closely aligned during this war. The U.S. and Israel have achieved a serious degradation of Iran's nuclear program, its ballistic missile program, Navy, other air defenses, and its industrial base needed to rebuild these capabilities. Israel is facing a diminished kinetic threat from Iran, according to the latest analysis from the Institute for the Study of War. The assessment published Tuesday said Iran launched its lowest missile barrage to date against Israel. The Institute said this may be the result of the deaths of a local Iranian commanders by the U.S. and Israel, creating challenges for command and control. Despite the crushing blows to its military, Iran has proven a capable adversary, causing global economic turmoil by closing the Strait of Hormuz, which has caused the price of oil to spike and disrupted shipments of fertilizer and other key commodities. Trump is facing tremendous pressure to rein in gas prices, which toppled $4 a gallon on average this week, as his approval rating in the economy falls to all-time lows. The president is also facing pushback from Republicans and his MAGA base over the potential use of ground troops, which analysts say would be necessary to reopen the strait unless Trump reaches a negotiated truce with Tehran. If Trump calls on Israel to halt attacks, Netanyahu will likely go along, said Herzog. "I think it's a safe bet," he said. More uncertain is where Trump stands on Israel's expanding military operations in Lebanon. Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed military group in southern Lebanon, began attacking Israel on March 2 in retaliation for the war launched against Iran. Hezbollah's entrance into the fray terminated an already shaky ceasefire between Lebanon and Israel. If the geography of Iran is complicated for Israel, Lebanon is right there, said Natan Sachs, senior fellow with the Middle East Institute. There, Israel plans to have a much longer campaign. There is a real potential difference between the countries, but it depends on Trump. Former President Biden negotiated the November 2024 ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon, which was aimed at weakening and sidelining Hezbollah. The Trump administration put its support behind the fragile deal, even fast-tracking $230 million to Beirut before a government shutdown in October 2025. But Israel is taking a harder line against Hezbollah this round, with Defense Minister Israel Katz on Tuesday saying Israel plans to push ground troops deeper into southern Lebanon with orders to raise villages home to 600,000 people, and establish a permanent Israeli buffer zone. This is dramatic and very aggressive. It could potentially go counter to American policy, Sachs said. It's not clear if the Trump administration is still in favor of pushing for direct talks between Israel and Lebanon, like it did in December, with the U.S. chairing a historic meeting between Lebanese and Israeli officials in a ceasefire monitoring meeting. The point of direct negotiations is to strengthen Beirut's sovereignty and political legitimacy to combat Hezbollah, a political and military force based in southern Lebanon. There is no other way to preserve Lebanon from foreign interference than by strengthening its state, its institutions and sovereignty, the foreign ministers from 9 European countries, the United Kingdom and the EU, said in a joint statement calling for direct talks between Israel and Lebanon. We call on Israel to avoid further widening of the conflict, including through a ground operation on Lebanese territory, the statement continued. The State Department did not immediately return a request for comment on whether the U.S. supports such an initiative. The story: Trump's Surgeon General nominee caught in GOP crossfire over MAHA. President Trump's nominee for U.S. Surgeon General appears stuck in the Senate, the latest sign that some Republicans in Congress have reached their limit on the more divisive aspects of the Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA, agenda. While the Surgeon General wields no direct regulatory powers, the nation's top doctor has a powerful bully pulpit, one that some in the GOP seem hesitant to hand over to Casey Means, a healthy living influencer with an expired medical license and no plans to renew it. Trump indicated he was open to withdrawing her nomination over the weekend before the White House swiftly reaffirmed its support for Means, the sister of White House senior advisor Callie Means, an influential figure in Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s orbit. Mark Brewer, a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine, said lawmakers might be getting gun-shy following poor performances by Trump nominees, but he argued the apparent reluctance to confirm Casey Means likely has more to do with her specific background. She doesn't have the appropriate qualifications. She doesn't really have kind of any public health experience per se, said Brewer, echoing criticism from Jerome Adams, a physician who served as Surgeon General during Trump's first term. If she were to be installed as a Surgeon General, I think it would send a message, he added, and at least some senators are not interested, it appears, in the message that would send. More than a month after her confirmation hearing before the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, or HELP, there has been no movement on her nomination, and there do not seem to be any immediate plans to bring her nomination up for a vote. Brewer noted that Republican Senators Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, the HELP Committee Chair, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Susan Collins of Maine, the latter two being the sole GOP holdouts on Means' confirmation, are uniquely immune from Trump's ire to a certain degree. He's got less leverage over those three senators than maybe he would have over some other members of the Senate, Brewer said. He's already kind of threatened Cassidy, right? And so he's already done what he can do there. Collins, he's got to be careful with if he wants the Republicans to control the Senate, he added. Murkowski has already proven that. You know, she's got her own brand in Alaska, and that she isn't necessarily reliant on even a party's endorsement, right? I mean, she ran without that and won. Trump has endorsed Representative Julia Letlow of Louisiana in the Republican primary against Cassidy, a career gastroenterologist who voted to impeach Trump following the January 6, 2021 insurrection. Collins is anticipated to face a tough challenge from Democratic candidate Graham Platner, who is holding a healthy lead over Maine Governor Janet Mills in the state's Senate primary race. Murkowski, who has flirted with leaving the Republican Party entirely, will next face re-election in 2028. Following Means' confirmation hearing, Murkowski and Collins said they walked away with unanswered questions about the nominee. In the weeks since, they have not said whether they'll vote to confirm her. Murkowski, an ardent proponent of vaccinations, took issue with Means' seeming skepticism of hepatitis B vaccines for newborns, Means said she believed the shot to be effective, calling past characterizations of her views incomplete. Collins, meanwhile, expressed concerns about Means' self-professed use of hallucinogenic psilocybin mushrooms. "I still have reservations," Murkowski told The Hill last month. The Alaska senator said at the time she did not plan on having another meeting with Means. With no Democrats on the HELP committee expected to support Means, two opposing votes on the Republican side would be effectively end any hope of confirmation. The Hill has reached out to the offices of Cassidy, Collins, and Murkowski for comment. The White House defended Means' credentials in its statement supporting her after Trump's remarks earlier this week. An alumna of Stanford University and the Stanford School of Medicine, there is no one better suited to advance President Trump's agenda to make America healthy again, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said in a statement. The president stands by her, and the Senate should move to quickly confirm Dr. Means as our next Surgeon General without further delay. MAHA Action, the PAC backing Kennedy's movement, has also been lobbying senators to advance her nomination. The MAHA movement deserves a Surgeon General who will tell the truth, not a mouthpiece for the broken status quo, the group said in a social media campaign earlier this month. Senator Susan Collins and Senator Lisa Murkowski appear to be the two Republican holdouts during this confirmation process. It's time for MAHA to get loud. As with several of Trump's nominees, there is also a concerted push opposing Means from communities outside Congress. The political action organization Stand Up for Science has been mobilizing doctors and scientists to speak out against her confirmation. Bill Cassidy is in this situation where, at this point, he kind of has nothing to lose by saying no. Colette Dalawala, the organization's president and CEO, told The Hill, "We know him, Collins and Murkowski and Tillis. They're all getting a lot of calls from our folks." Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, who does not sit on the HELP committee, told The Washington Post he's likely no if Means' nomination makes it to the floor vote. The timing of Means' confirmation process is also less than ideal. When saying he was open to withdrawing her nomination, Trump told reporters, "I'm more focused on Iran." This is coming at a moment when certainly President Trump and the administration are feeling most embattled just because of the war, because of oil prices, because of the midterms. And so I think there's less tolerance in the GOP right now to do absolutely everything he wants. Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, told The Hill. And there is more willingness to find points where they can, maybe at a lower level issues, separate themselves a little bit. Means' confirmation push comes on the heels of former Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem being fired, the first cabinet member but not the only Senate confirmed official to be let go. Former Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Susan Monterez was fired less than a month after she was officially confirmed for the role. Cassidy indicated that Monterez's firing was a poor use of Republican time and support. If someone is fired 29 days after every Republican votes for her, the Senate confirms her, the secretary said at her swearing-in, that she has unimpeachable scientific credentials, and the president called her an incredible mother and dedicated public servant. Like, what happened? Did we fail? Was there something we should have done differently? Cassidy said in a hearing after Monterez's termination. This track record may be informing how senators are handling Means's, Zelizer said. Letting go of people leaving, it doesn't create the incentive to invest everything if you're a Republican, and the big timing is the midterms keep getting closer and closer, he said. And so if they're going to be unstable, the administration, I think on certain picks, some Republicans will be more willing to vote no and figure it'll be okay. The story, McConnell joins Democrats to defend U.S. NATO membership. Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, joined Democratic lawmakers in supporting the U.S.'s membership in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, after President Trump said he was considering withdrawing from the alliance. NATO is the most successful military alliance in history. It has underpinned the security of the United States for more than 70 years, McConnell said in a joint statement with Senator Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, on Wednesday. The U.S. is one of NATO's 12 original founding members, having signed the agreement in 1949, Trump told The Telegraph in an interview published on Wednesday that the U.S.'s exit from the alliance is beyond consideration. "I was never swayed by NATO," he told the outlet. "I always knew they were a paper tiger, and Russian President Vladimir Putin knows that too, by the way. The president has previously criticized the alliance for their reluctance to support the U.S.'s ongoing military operations against Iran, labeling them cowards. They didn't want to join the fight to stop a nuclear-powered Iran," Trump wrote in a Truth Social post last month. "Now that fight is militarily won, with very little danger for them." McConnell is the chair, and Coons is the ranking member of the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense. "Alliance disputes are as old as the alliance itself," the lawmakers wrote. "Americans are safer when NATO is strong and united. It is in our interest for all allies to tend this unity with care." Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, the vice chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, similarly defended the U.S.'s NATO membership on Wednesday. "For more than 70 years, NATO has been the cornerstone of American national security, deterring war in Europe, projecting strength around the world, and ensuring that the United States never stands alone in moments of crisis," he wrote in a Wednesday statement. "It's not a paper tiger. It's the most successful military alliance in modern history. And Donald Trump's threat to pull the United States out of NATO is reckless, dangerous, and plays directly into the hands of our adversaries." The story, Ty Cobb, late night Trump posts prove he's gone. Former White House attorney Ty Cobb suggested on Tuesday that President Trump's rhetoric and late night musings on social media about the ongoing conflict with Iran are demonstrating his cognitive decline. "It's not a surprise that we're in this much trouble," Cobb told independent journalist Jim Acosta during an appearance on the former CNN anchor's streaming show. "It's not a surprise given the fact that the cabinet will not invoke the 25th Amendment for a man who is clearly insane, and this war highlights that." Cobb ripped Trump's nightly screeds, with which he said the president uses to vent without oversight about a range of political issues, including the war. "You think he's just gone?" Acosta asked. "I think he's gone," Cobb replied. Trump launched his social media platform, Truth Social, in early 2022 after he was banned from Facebook and the platform formerly known as Twitter following the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. It quickly became Trump's official mouthpiece, allowing him to circumvent traditional media to announce policy, air personal grievances, criticize opponents, and communicate directly with his base. He often engages in late night or early morning posting sprees, churning out dozens, sometimes hundreds, of so-called truths and retruths over a span of a few hours. Trump's affinity for social media posting has been on display for years, even before he had his own platform. He racked up 200 tweets and retweets amid nationwide protests against police brutality in June 2020, according to Business Insider. Questions surrounding Trump's mental fitness have risen in recent months, spurred by his tendency to embark on rambling tangents and instances where he appeared to doze off or close his eyes during events and meetings. A Reuters Ipsos poll released last month found that roughly 6 in 10 Americans believe Trump is becoming more erratic with age. Trump will turn 80 years old in June. Trump has dismissed concerns about his health and mental acuity, using Truth Social in December to rip seditious reporting about the matter. "The New York Times and some others like to pretend that I am slowing up, am maybe not as sharp as I once was, or am in poor physical health, knowing that it is not true, and knowing that I work very hard, probably harder than I have ever worked before," Trump wrote at the time. Trump also told New York Magazine in January that he closed his eyes during cabinet meetings because they are boring as hell. The story, Barr leads wide-open Kentucky GOP Senate primary. Representative Andy Barr, Republican of Kentucky, is leading in the Republican primary for Kentucky's U.S. Senate seat, according to new polling data published Thursday. The Emerson College polling, Fox 56 survey, found that 28% of likely GOP Kentucky voters support the sitting lawmaker in the primary contest. Barr is up against Attorney General Daniel Cameron and businessman Nate Morris, who are polling at 21% and 15%, according to the new poll. 29% of the survey's respondents said they are still undecided about for whom they will vote in the May 19 primary. Support for Barr has increased since the Polling Center's February survey, which reported support from 24% of likely Republican voters in the state. Barr is seeking to fill retiring Senator Mitch McConnell's seat in the upper chamber of Congress. McConnell is the longest-serving Senate leader in U.S. history. He will mark a total of 42 years in office at the end of his current term. The GOP congressman has centered his campaign on issues championed by President Trump, including tightened border control policies, tax cut legislation, and gun rights. The president has not yet endorsed a candidate in the primary, praising all three Republicans during a March speech in the state. Nearly half of 46% of Kentucky Republicans polled in this new poll said a Trump endorsement would make them more likely to support a candidate in this primary race. 41% said an endorsement from the president would have no impact on their vote, while 13% said they would be less likely to support a candidate who is backed by Trump. Emerson College polling, Fox 56 polled 1,050 likely Kentucky voters from both political parties about their choices in the state's upcoming Democratic and Republican primary elections. The survey was conducted from March 29 to 31, with a margin of error of approximately 2.9%. The story: Trump ramps up war on mail-in voting ahead of midterms. President Trump is ramping up his war on mail-in voting with a new attempt to reshape how elections are run ahead of this year's high-stakes midterms. Trump on Tuesday signed an executive order to limit mail-in ballots, mandating the creation of a list of eligible voters in each state and restricting absentee ballots to voters who on said list. During the signing, he repeated his false allegations about widespread cheating through mail-in voting after he voted by mail from his Mar-a-Lago resort in a Florida special election just last week. The move drew swift pushback from election experts and Democratic officials who say the president lacks the authority. It's the latest move in the president's crackdown on mail ballots, which he has ruffled even some Republicans as the party grapples with his sweeping plans to overhaul U.S. elections. If this actually happens, and I have to stress that it won't, if the president's executive order went into effect as described, particularly for the 26 elections, it would be chaos for Republicans, said Justin Levitt, a constitutional law professor at Loyola Law School. Trump's new order directs the U.S. Postal Service to send ballots only to eligible voters on a list to be drawn up by the Department of Homeland Security with help from the Social Security Administration. Approved mail-in ballot envelopes would also be equipped with unique barcodes for tracking, and states that don't comply could see their federal funding withheld. Democratic leaders have ripped the move, which they argue would encroach upon states' power over elections. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York, called the order an unlawful power grab, while Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, pledged to see you in court. Democratic secretaries of state have offered similar rebukes. The president's latest executive order is another desperate illegal power grab. The Constitution is clear. States run elections. We don't need decrees from Washington, D.C. My message to the president, we'll see you in court, Oregon Secretary of State Tobias Reed said in a post on the social platform X. Oregon is one of eight states plus Washington, D.C. that send all voters their ballots by mail automatically and without request. 28 states allow no-excuse absentee voting, meaning voters can request an absentee ballot, while the remaining states require an excuse to qualify. Trump has long claimed without evidence that mail-in ballots and instances of immigrants without documentation voting contributed to widespread fraud in the 2020 presidential election, which he lost against former President Biden. On Tuesday, he insisted that he won the White House three times convincingly. Those claims have formed the backdrop for his calls to nationalize elections and for Congress to pass the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act, a Republican-backed bill that would require Americans to show proof of citizenship to register to vote and provide a valid ID in order to cast a ballot. He's panned the practice in some states of allowing mail-in ballots to come in after Election Day, as long as they were postmarked in time. Trump's Department of Justice, or DOJ, meanwhile, has also demanded that states turn over voter data, raising election interference concerns. Republicans eager to align with the president have been largely supportive of Trump's plan to overhaul elections, but his stance on voting by mail has put him at odds with some Republicans who hail from states where absentee voting is widespread and popular. If Trump's order were to take effect, experts say it could sow chaos in GOP-led states as the party fights to keep control of Congress in the midterms. Some of these states have already pushed back against the DOJ's push for voter roll access. Last month, Idaho, which has voted for Trump every time he's been on the ballot, became the latest state to decline to share sensitive information with Washington. The president cast a ballot by mail in a Florida special election as recently as last week, asked why he's taken part in a process he called mail-in cheating. Trump has said it was because I'm president of the United States. He added that he couldn't be there because I had a lot of different things. Rick Hazen, an election law professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, called the president a total hypocrite on voting by mail. He said that it's prone to fraud, and yet he and his family use it regularly. It's just a talking point. It's not backed by reliable evidence, Hazen told The Hill in an interview just before Trump's Tuesday announcement. Karen Siebold, a political science professor at the University of Arkansas, described Trump's policy views as kind of fluid. You might be with him one day and against him the next, she said of the president's approach to elections. In Arkansas, two candidates in a Tuesday GOP primary runoff for Secretary of State underscored some of the conflicting views on election administration within the party. Both contenders for the state's top elections official post touted their alignment with Trump but differed on their stance on paper ballots. Brian Norris, who lost to State Senator Kim Hammer, Republican Tuesday, advocated for paper ballots, a popular call among Trump and his allies amid their efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Hammer, meanwhile, spearheaded legislation seeking to place the financial burden of paper ballots on counties that elect to use the tabulation method. I think it makes it really hard for Republicans to strategize and figure out how to stick with Trump while also not being wishy-washy and going back and forth, Siebold said. This isn't the playbook for how you win power and keep it. Experts say Trump's new executive order isn't likely to survive legal challenges, however. It's unconstitutional. The president doesn't have any power to instruct the Postal Service on which mail to deliver and which mail not to deliver, Levitt said. He doesn't have magical powers. Trump signed a sweeping executive order last year targeting mail-in ballots, enforcing an Election Day receipt deadline in federal elections after years of unproven claims about mail-in voting fraud. A judge later halted enforcement of parts of that order. Even if the new order is defeated, experts say the move risks sowing confusion and distrust among voters. Elections are going on. We've had special elections, so trying to do all of this leading up to the midterm election also just creates confusion, and it's already tricky, said Michael Hanmer, a University of Maryland political science professor with a focus on voting and elections. The new order, which Hanmer said isn't realistic, comes amid poor approval numbers for Trump, and as polls suggest, Democrats have the midterm edge. If, as any reasonable prediction, would go for the midterm elections, especially when you factor in Trump's current popularity or lack thereof, it's looking pretty bad for Republicans, he added. And so this can be another excuse. The story, Marjorie Taylor Greene says all she heard from Trump's speech was war, war, war. Former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, slammed President Trump's Wednesday evening speech about his administration's ongoing military operations against Iran. I wanted so much for President Trump to put America first, Greene wrote in a post on X. That's what I believed he would do. All I heard from his speech tonight was war, war, war. In a 20-minute address to the nation on Wednesday evening, the president said his administration was on track to complete all of America's military objectives shortly, very shortly. He also threatened to hit each and every one of the country's energy infrastructure if Tehran does not agree to a peace deal in the coming weeks. "We were going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong," Trump said. In the meantime, discussions are ongoing. The retired congresswoman listed out a number of issues she wished the president had addressed, including affordability, the national debt, Social Security funding, insurance costs, employment opportunities, education, and the future of the nation. "I'm so beyond done," Green wrote on the social platform X. "I pray for our military and their families. I pray for innocent people all over the world. I pray for peace and prosperity for all." Democratic Senator Andy Kim of New Jersey joined in on criticizing the president's speech and the U.S. operations against Iran, calling them an absolute disaster in an X post. "He keeps telling us the war is about to end, but those are just lies. Trump needs to end this," Kim said. "He cannot be allowed to deploy troops on the ground. He cannot keep making the American people pay billions." Republicans such as Senator Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina, commended the administration's actions in the Middle East. "President Trump is right about the fanatical regime in Iran," Scott wrote in an X post. "For too long they chanted death to America, pursued nuclear weapons, and killed Americans. The objective is clear, and I'm thankful our military is delivering on the mission," the senator continued. "Americans are safer as a result." The story: when could jet fuel supply run low for the U.S.? Jet fuel prices in the U.S. have increased since the start of the Iran war, and tensions are squeezing supply and raising concerns of a shortage. According to the Argus U.S. Jet Fuel Index, the average price of jet fuel has jumped from $2.50 per gallon on February 27, near the start of the conflict, to $4.64 per gallon as of Wednesday. Amid concerns of a looming shortage, airlines in the U.S. are looking to offset the rising fuel prices. On Monday, JetBlue announced it was raising baggage fees by as much as $9, pointing to the rising operation costs. "While we recognize that fee increases are never ideal, we take careful consideration to ensure these changes are implemented only when necessary," the carrier said in a statement. United Airlines has also said it would scale back service in some areas, and Delta and American Airlines have said they would pass costs on to consumers, expecting to add $400 million in costs just for fuel. Airlines have warned the supply could run out in a matter of weeks, contrary to a social media post from President Trump on Tuesday, in which he said the U.S. had plenty of jet fuel compared to other countries facing disruptions. The story: cicada COVID variant detected in these states. A COVID-19 variant with a catchy nickname is causing concern, despite making up a small fraction of current cases. The BA.3.2 variant was first detected in South Africa in late 2024, before making its way to the United States, where it's been increasingly detected in wastewater samples since September of 2025. It earned the nickname the cicada variant since it mutated from the Omicron strain, which has been somewhat dormant for years, just like the cicada broods rest dormant underground before emerging every few years. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention uses wastewater surveillance as a tool to survey the spread of COVID-19 and its many variants. The agency has also detected the BA.3.2 in nasal swabs from travelers and clinical samples from patients sick with the virus. So far, the BA.3.2 variant has been confirmed in more than half of U.S. states: California, Connecticut, Colorado, Florida, Hawaii, Idaho, Illinois, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Missouri, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, and Wyoming. The data is only current through February 11, and so it does not include any states where the variant may have spread in late February or March, BA3.2 still makes up a small percentage of COVID-19 cases in the U.S., according to CDC tracking. There is also no evidence that the cicada strain causes more severe disease other than other dominant variants of COVID, writes Dr. Kyle Enfield, an associate professor of medicine at the University of Virginia, in an article in The Conversation. Instead, the concern is that the strain isn't a good match for the current COVID-19 vaccine, which was formulated to target the JN.1 lineage. That means the BA3.2 type, which has a substantially different spike protein, could be better at evading the vaccine. Dr. Enfield still recommends a vaccine which can still prime your immune system to fight off all types of COVID-19, but if you have concerns that the vaccine doesn't offer enough protection, you can also use other steps to avoid getting sick, like washing your hands, wearing a mask in crowds, and avoiding people who aren't feeling well. The story, thousands more U.S. troops headed to Middle East aboard aircraft carrier. The U.S. is sending thousands of additional U.S. service members to the Middle East aboard the aircraft carrier USS George H.W. Bush, even as President Trump on Wednesday claimed Iran has asked the U.S. for a ceasefire. The George H.W. Bush deployed Tuesday en route to the Middle East, along with three destroyers, a carrier strike group that consists of more than 6,000 sailors, two U.S. officials told the Associated Press. The new deployment follows the Trump administration's decision to send 2,500 Marines and 2,000 paratroopers from the 82nd Airborne Division to the region last week. Officials have not disclosed what those troops would be doing. The Pentagon and the U.S. Central Command, the military command that oversees troops in the Middle East, did not immediately respond to questions on the deployments from the Hill. Tens of thousands of service members are already in the Middle East as the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran tips into its second month, with Trump threatening to escalate the conflict over the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, even as he has insisted hostilities could end soon. Iran's new regime president, much less radicalized and far more intelligent than its predecessors, has just asked the United States of America for a ceasefire, Trump said in a Wednesday morning post on his social media platform, Truth Social. He did not reveal who the leader was. We will consider when Hormuz Strait is open, free and clear. Until then, we are blasting Iran into oblivion, or as they say, back to the Stone Ages, he added. Trump also told Reuters on Wednesday that America will be out of Iran pretty quickly and could return for spot hits if needed. Administration officials have sidestepped questions about whether or not the U.S. will deploy troops on the group inside Iran, with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth on Tuesday saying Washington wants to be unpredictable in that scenario. We're not going to foreclose any option, Hegseth told reporters at a Pentagon briefing. You can't fight and win a war if you tell your adversary what you are willing to do or what you are not willing to do, to include boots on the ground. The USS George H.W. Bush would replace the USS Gerald R. Ford, which was in the Red Sea until a laundry room fire on March 12 forced it to sail to Crete, Greece, for repairs. The USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier has been in the Middle East since January. The story, Mark Kelly on Artemis II mission, this is something we've never done before. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, a retired NASA astronaut, said Wednesday that the Artemis II mission to the moon is uncharted territory for American space explorers. They're going to go 4,000 miles on the far side of the moon, which is something we've never done before, even during Apollo, Kelly told News Nation Henry Armour at Kennedy Space Center in Florida while donning his NASA uniform and a camo Navy hat. The Apollo crews went in low moon, low lunar orbit, he added, so this is something we've never done before.